Welcome to Haunting History, the podcast that reaches back into the past for the events that still haunt us today. Tales of true crime, mystery, and the macabre. And when we're lucky, the stories where history and the people who lived it and the paranormal meet. Now, who doesn't love a good ghost story, right? Welcome back to Haunting History Podcast. I'm your host, Kat.
And I'm Haley.
And today we're going to talk about a museum heist. You like UFO stories.
Mm-hmm.
You're okay with the ghost stories.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you feel about like bank robberies and museum heist? Are those good stories? Or are you?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you know what the difference between a heist and a robbery is?
Monetary value. I don't know.
Yeah. You just guessed at that?
Yeah. I don't know why that's like a.
Because I don't know. I didn't know the difference between a heist and a robbery. A heist is usually the act of stealing valuable items like artwork or gold bullion. And a robbery usually includes force. So that's why, like, if a museum is robbed, which is technically they're being robbed, right? It's a heist. They call it a heist because it's, like, valuable items. I don't know. I just, for some reason, thought about that earlier today. Like, what's the difference between the two? I'm kind of impressed that you kind of knew. In March of 1990, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, Massachusetts, was subject to a theft that is, to this day, considered the single largest property theft in the world. 34 years ago, on the night of March 18th, 1990. My God, 1990 was 34 years ago.
I mean, I'm almost 30.
You know, it's weird when you think about, like, 34 years sounds like a really long time, but 1990 doesn't seem like that long ago.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like how you see the TikToks now where young people are saying, like, well, if you were born in the 1900s.
Yeah, I saw this thing the other day that this lady was ranting on TikTok because she went to go buy something, like alcohol or something at the store, and she, like, handed him his ID, and he barely glanced at it, and she goes, don't you want to, like, look at it more? And he's like, no, ma'am, you're born in the 1900s. Like, he just looked at the year and was like, oh, it's like 1991 or whatever, and was like, no ma'am, you were born in the 1900s.
Does that make you feel old? Because you're born in the 1900s. See, that my only consolation, if someone says that, so were you. Like, you were born, you're young, so, like, for someone to say you were born in the 1900s, I'm lumped with you, so it doesn't make me feel as bad. But does it, like, freak you out?
Well, because 1994 does not sound like the 1900s. 1900 is like 1919 to me, like,
right? But it is not the same. It's only 1994. It's probably the 1900s.
Yeah.
So anyways, let's go back. And I should mention, I did not write this script. My sister did. My sister
Thanks,
was interested. I know. She was interested in the story, and she had actually watched, there's a documentary on the museum heist. So I had asked her, like, do you want to help me write scripts? Because we all know this is the hardest part of doing a podcast, is doing all the research and all the writing beforehand. And I asked her, and she said, I'm kind of interested in that Isabella Gardner museum heist. And so I said, go ahead and write a script. And I feel bad because she actually wrote this like a year ago, and we're just getting around to it now. But I had to make sure it was sort of like in our writing, and I just needed to go over it a lot. So 34 years ago, we're going back to 34 years ago, on the night of March 18th, 1990, two men dressed in Boston police uniforms gained entry into the museum. Within 81 minutes, they managed to get away with 13 valuable pieces of art. No one has ever been arrested for the crime. So this is unsolved, by the way. So when I was making my list of the stories you like, this one is unsolved. Isabel Stewart Gardner was born in New York City on April 12th, 1840. Her family was well off, with their father making his money from importing Irish linen and then investments. She grew up in the West Village and was privately schooled in the city, and then went on to finishing school in Paris, which was common during that time. It was there that she met her future husband, John Jack Lowell Gardner Jr. In 1860s, they wed in New York and moved to Jack's hometown of Boston, into a house that her father purchased for them as a wedding gift.
That would be nice.
I know. Haley's getting married. We're probably not going to be buying you a house, just FYI.
Well, that's because they're astronomically expensive.
Right now, for sure. In California. We live in California, too. Maybe back in Boston. But he didn't just buy a regular house. He bought her a mansion.
Okay, well.
So, congratulations on your wedding.
Thanks.
Here's a mansion. The couple traveled abroad often and developed a love of art. Isabella loved Venice, Italy, and its architecture and used it for the inspiration for her museum. The couple began collecting art for personal enjoyment, but it soon became too much for their home. They decided they would buy land and build a place to share their art with others as well as provide living quarters for themselves, which that just sounds like heaven to me to have your living quarters in a museum. Like, she lived above the museum.
Yeah.
Like, that sounds amazing. The only thing better would be a library.
Right.
To live in a library. Tragically, though, Jake died before his dream became a reality on December 10th of 1898. Isabella forged ahead with the plan, and the construction began in 1899, just a year later, on a new property that she felt was big enough to house her art and her home. Completed in 1901, Isabella lived on the fourth floor, and she herself created all the works of art to be displayed on the three lower floors. She acquired many forms of art, painting, sculptures, tapestry, furniture, manuscripts, rare books, collective decorative arts. She continued on this very personal work until her death in 1924. She was a fascinating woman, and the architecture and vision for the museum is unique and beautiful with gardens and courtyards. I highly recommend going to the museum website because, like, I'm not probably going to be in Boston anytime soon, but you can go to the museum website, which we'll have a link to it, and read up on the history and look at all the pictures and all the artwork that's there. It's kind of, if I did go to Boston, I would definitely go there. I got most of the recounting of the heist from the transcript of the audio tour you can take at the museum. The full transcript as well as the audio recording is available on their website. On March 18th, 1990, two men dressed as Boston police arrived at the locked outside museum door at 1:24 a.m. Through the intercom, they informed the two on-duty security guards that they were reporting to a report of a disturbance. This event took place during the overnight hours. Here's the thing, because it sounds really weird for the police to be like, oh, we're responding to a disturbance, and the security guards in the museum not know of any disturbance, except that this took place during the overnight hours of the St. Patrick's Day Parade, which is the biggest, I think Boston has the biggest St. Patrick's Day Parade in the nation. And so it didn't seem weird for there to be something going on that they didn't know of inside, only because of what was going on outside. Like,
yeah, I think it would be normal to have something go on outside and then need to check around.
Right. And if it had been any other night, I don't think that the security guards would have had like second thoughts about it. But because it happened on the night that there are so many thousands, tens and maybe even hundreds of thousands of people that are in the area during that night. So it didn't seem weird. And I actually did a side note. Bostonians were the first to celebrate St. Patrick's Day in North America on March 17th, 1737, as a gesture of solidarity among the city's new Irish immigrants, Boston's Irish community joined together in festivities of their homeland and to honor the memory of the patron saint of Ireland. The parade is still the largest and probably the rowdiest St. Patrick's Day celebration in America. Many parade goers were still celebrating in the streets at like 1:25, and that's normally a quiet time for that neighborhood. So a possibility for a call of disturbance didn't seem outlandish. Although it was against protocol to allow anyone in after hours, the overnight guards made the decision to buzz in who they believed was law enforcement. One side of the building, the two uniformed men were able to overwhelm the two guards, and they covered their mouth and their eyes with duct tape and took them to the basement where they handcuffed them to pipes and locked them in separate areas. Once the guards were secured, the thieves had free rein of the museum and felt like they could take their time. Their first stop was a Dutch room. It's believed that their main target was the work of art by Dutch artist Rembrandt. Born Rembrandt van Rijn, which I believe is how you, it's either Rijn or Rain, on July 16th, 1606, he was simply known as Rembrandt. He was a Dutch Golden Age painter, printmaker, and draftsman. He is considered to be one of the greatest visual artists in the history of art. His work encompassed a large scope of styles from portrait, landscapes, scenes of historical, biblical, and mythological themes, as well as self-portraits. There's a debate about how many works Rembrandt created in the early 20th century, with some counts at over 600 paintings, 400 etchings, and 2,000 drawings. In the 60s, those numbers were greatly reduced and are still being reevaluated. Some of the reasons for the uncertainty is due to the fact that it is believed that he had students reproduce his own self-portraits, and some of those initially were counted as his own work. Rembrandt's works on display in museums around the world. The Gardner was actually the last museum in Massachusetts who had never had a Rembrandt stolen until that night. That's so sad. The first work they selected in this room was a seascape, and the only seascape painted by Rembrandt. The thieves took the painting off the wall and placed it on the floor. Motion sensors were able to trace their path that night, and all of it was recorded. The museum had what was known as a dot matrix printer. I mean, I barely remember those. You probably haven't even heard of them. Which printed out their route. Like, it literally knew by the movements in the museum, like, where they went first and where they went second, all that stuff. Not realizing that security personnel just had to hit a button to reprint the report, they had actually grabbed the printed report, thinking that no one would know what they had done while they were there. But they didn't know that you could just press a button and reprint it. Their second target was another Rembrandt. It's a double portrait of a couple. They took the painting down, put it on the floor, and they used a blade or a box cutter to cut the painting out of the frame. So they didn't care about keeping it valuable, because that diminishes its value, obviously.
Right.
It's tragic to see the lack of regard for the valuable artwork. After that, they go for another painting in the same room. There's a landscape painting they believe is a Rembrandt. In the 1980s, it was uncovered that the painting was actually the work of a student of Rembrandt, not the artist himself. So that painting was not really a Rembrandt. There are two other paintings in this room. One is a treasured Vermeer called The Concert. It's a very rare item, as Vermeer only painted 36 paintings. This time, the thieves moved the art to the middle of the room and hold the frame down upside down and broke the glass on the floor. And then removed the canvas from the back of the frame and then dropped the frame, and it, like, shattered. So it's weird. You would think that, like, a museum heist, like, people who would do that would know what they're doing with the art.
Would understand the value of it.
Instead of just willy-nilly, like, just, I mean, fundamentally, you would think you would know taking something out of the frame is going to affect its value.
Well, I didn't know taking it out of the frame would affect it, but definitely cutting it the canvas shorter, yeah.
In the same room, there's a table that night that held a Chinese bronze vessel. The item is very old, but it's not of huge value. The thieves tried in vain to remove the vessel. However, it's attached to the metal base it's sitting on, so it can't be removed. And they leave it there and move on. Their next hit is a small frame screwed to a wooden cabinet. They unscrewed the frame, removed the postage size stamp of a black and white etching, which is in Rembrandt also. And then they take an actual full 5 minutes removing that little piece of artwork from the frame. Keep in mind, the majority of the art thieves usually take less than 5 minutes total. And they spent 5 minutes alone taking... Why? It was tiny. I mean, it's little. Why did they bother to do that? Nobody knows. They were clearly very confident that no one was coming to catch them.
Yeah.
There's another Rembrandt in this room. It's a self-portrait. However, the thieves made a mistake. They took the frame down and removed the back. Then they removed the canvas from the back and take it, leaving the frame laying on the floor, like, face down. What they don't realize is that the frame actually contained two pieces of art, and they stole the other piece, leaving the Rembrandt intact. Like, when it was a Rembrandt on front and then another piece of work behind it. And when they turned it upside down and took the canvas out, they were taking the one that wasn't valuable and left the one that was valuable just laying on the floor.
Yep.
The thieves spent about 40 minutes in that Dutch room. And then while one of the thieves continues to work the Dutch room, the other moved on. He moves through a dark hallway, through a gallery, without taking anything, and enters a room past it. It's a small, narrow gallery called the Short Gallery. The Short Gallery contains panels that swing open and contain multiple layers of drawings. He takes five drawings, the first by Edgar Degas. After taking the drawings, the thief sets his sights on a flag from the Napoleon's Guard Regiment. It's like he half-heartedly removed a few of the screws, gives up, and leaves it. It's perplexing as to why he doesn't break the glass, because they broke the glass in the other room, but they didn't break the glass just to take that. He doesn't leave empty-handed, though. From the frame with the flag, he removes and takes a metal eagle that was attached. It actually takes time for the museum to even notice that that was missing, because initial stories don't even include that item. The thief then heads back to his partner in the Dutch room. It's interesting to point out that on this journey, the thief passes through the Chinese room. In this room, there's a glass cabinet that contains two ancient bronze bears. Unlike the low-value vase that they were trying to steal, that they spent minutes and time to try and remove, these two ancient bronze bears are really high value. and they could have just broken the glass and taken them. So they didn't know what they were doing, yeah. essentially. These missteps led many to believe that the thieves were not well-versed in art valuation, obviously. The pair now have 12 pieces of art, 6 from the dust room, 5 drawings, and the eagle from the short gallery. They now head downstairs. After arriving downstairs, they separately make 2 trips each to load their vehicle with the stolen works of art. The time is now 2:45, and they've been in the museum for 1 hour and 21 minutes. They do end up taking an additional piece. It is unknown when they retrieve this art. There aren't any movements recorded in or on the way to the room that it was housed in. The next stolen item is from the blue room. This is a first floor room that initially was used as a ladies' reception area for concerts. It is designed to display collections up close with a personal, like, intimate feel. Although a piece of work is taken from the room, the sensors never go off and it's unknown at what point they went into the room. The piece was a small portrait of a man in a top hat and was painted by Edouard Manet. During the investigation the next day, the sensors to the room work fine. The investigators find the frame to this small portrait empty at the security desk. The thieves seem to have no consistency, using different techniques to retrieve their loot. Everything they steal from the second floor follows one style, the Manet in the blue room, another style. Nothing else is taken from the first floor, and they never even go up to the third floor. Now, these are the suspects for the last 34 years. Over the years, there's been many theories on who's responsible for the heist. The Netflix 4-part series, This is a Robbery, the World's Biggest Art Heist, goes into depth with several of the key suspects, but the truth is, it's still an open case. No one has ever been charged, and none of the pieces have ever been found. Wait, God, that just kind of breaks my heart a little bit. Like, where are these pieces of art? Do they get destroyed? Are they in someone's basement?
But what would be the purpose of doing that if not to sell it and make money?
Right.
But I mean, what, 1990?
Yeah.
You could sell things and it not be on the internet. You know?
Yeah. Like, now it'd be a little bit different. But back then you'd think that they would only do it if they had a buyer.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They might have. It didn't have to be over the internet.
I'm going to go over the most popular names. If you want to go into a deep dive, the documentary series has a lot more information. From the beginning, the FBI was on the case. There was very little physical evidence, basically none. No footprints, no conclusive fingerprints. And due to the times, there was a limit on how these things were processed. Obviously, they don't process the same things in 2024 that they did in 1990. They have been able to do some DNA analysis in more recent years, but nothing came of that. And over time, samples have been lost or misplaced. There are some eyewitnesses on the street, and of course, the 2 security guards were able to give some description of their attackers. Now, the 2 thieves were dressed as Boston PD. One of the men has been said to be around 5'9", with a medium build in his late 30s. The second is thought to be 6'1", in his early 30s, and a heavier build. One of the first suspects was actually also a victim. Security guard Rick Abeth is the one who lets the thieves into the museums. While making his rounds early in his shift, he had opened and shut the side door. Many people think he did this to alert the thieves or to give them the all-clear sign so they can make their move. I don't know. When questioned, because I don't know, what time did he do that? Like, it wasn't like an all-clear. He didn't do that at 1 o'clock and they came in at 1:24. Like, he did it earlier in his shift. It says, when questioned about the act later, he claimed that he routinely did this on his rounds to check to make sure the door was actually locked. A fellow employee disputes his claim, saying it would have been against procedure to do that, and it would show up on a computer printout if he had actually opened and closed the door. His claim could not be confirmed by those reports. Another point of interest was that about the previously mentioned blue room. As we said, the sensors did not go off during the heist. However, they did go off when Abbott entered the room while making his rounds, and again the next morning during the investigation. The equipment was reviewed and it was in good working condition. Rick Abbott maintains his innocence, and the FBI agent in charge of the case decided that both guards were too incompetent and foolish to pull off a heist.
It honestly sounds like these guys that did pull off the heist are a little foolish.
Doesn't it kind of match? Although it doesn't sound like the thieves are probably rocket scientists either. In 2015, there was a footage released from the museum the night before the theft. The video shows Abbott letting an unknown man in and showed him talking to them at the security desk. When they questioned Abbott about it, he claimed to not remember the man or the event. So the FBI publicly released it, asking anyone who recognized the stranger to come forward. Several former museum employees did. They ID'd the man as Rick Abbas Boss, the museum deputy security chief. Mob boss Whitey Bulger was also considered a suspect. He was considered a very powerful leader in the Winter Hill Gang in Boston. He always refuted his involvement and went so far as to send his people out to try and figure out who did it. He considered the museum as part of his turf and was angry that someone may have imposed on it, and he wanted to collect his fair share of the haul. His possible involvement had some theorizing that his known ties to the police department would explain the use of the police uniforms by the thieves, or that possibly the actual police department had some involvement under his direction. Whitey also has ties with the Irish Republic Army in Ireland, and some felt that they could be involved in the crime. There is a theory created by a retired investigator for the Scotland Yard, was that Whitey gave the art to the Irish Republican Army, and he believes that the pieces are somewhere in Ireland. I don't know. I mean, I guess a gangster in Boston would have had the ability to have enough people to pull something off like that. In 1994, an anonymous person sent a letter to the museum claiming they were representing a person who had the art and wanted to negotiate its return. They went on to explain that the works were initially stolen in order to use it as a negotiation tool for a prison term. This never happened, and that person wanted to return the art to the museum. They claimed all the works were safe and in a non-common law country, in a climate-controlled environment. The author of the letter claimed to not know the thieves, but was asked to anonymously negotiate for $6 million and no charges for themselves or the holder of the art. They directed the museum, if interested in creating a deal, to print a coded message in the Boston Globe. The writer also supplied some details that only the museum and the FBI knew at the time. Believing this to be a credible source, the museum had the Globe print the coded message. A few days later, another letter arrived acknowledging the museum's readiness to make a deal, but they now feared that agencies involved with the investigation would probably be able to identify them, and they needed time to consider their next step, and that was the last the museum ever heard from them.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, because that would indicate that whoever stole them had the ability to store them in a climate-controlled environment. You know what I mean? That doesn't sound like two bumbling thieves. Like, even to even know that it needed to be stored in a climate-controlled environment after cutting them out of frames.
Right.
That doesn't make sense. Brian McDebbie was a con man from Boston who tried to rob the Hyde Collection in Glen Falls, New York in 1981. He was initially considered a good suspect in the Gardner case because there were some similarities in the robbery attempt from 81. There, he had disguised himself as a FedEx driver and had handcuffs and duct tape with him. His intention was to steal a Rembrandt. He was also known as a flag aficionado. Remember, they stole the Napoleon flag? And his body type fit the description of the largest suspect. He was interviewed by the FBI in the late 90s and refused to take a lie detector test. It was determined that his fingerprints did not match any of the scenes, so the FBI had nothing further on him. There was another gang the FBI considered as possible suspects. In March of 2013, the FBI declared with a high degree of confidence that they had identified the thieves, a criminal organization that was based in the Mid-Atlantic New England region. They believed this gang had moved the works of art to Connecticut and Philadelphia and had tried to unload some of it in Philadelphia in 2002. After that incident, though, the case goes cold. The FBI turns to the public's help in 2015. Okay, so I'm thinking 2015, that doesn't seem that long ago. That's like 9 years ago. Like, even 2015 is 9 freaking years ago, right? Yeah. While the suspects were never named publicly, it's believed they were referring to the Merlino gang run by Carmelo Merlino. It seems that the group had ties with another mobster, Louis Royce, who had earlier had plans to rob the museum and had done research and legwork to complete it. Even though Royce never put the plan into action, the FBI uncovered the details while he was being investigated for other crimes. While he was in prison at the time of the Gardner heist, he shared the information with others who had contact with the Merlino gang. The FBI says both thieves had passed away. Two members of interest from the Merlino gang was Robert Gorenti, and Robert Gentile. Gorenti died of cancer in 2004. His widow claimed that her husband had some paintings that he had given them to Gentile to keep for him when he got sick in the early 2000s. Gentile claimed the story was false and that he was unaware of any paintings or their whereabouts. Federal authorities indicted Gentile on drug charges in 2012 in what is believed by many to be an attempt to get him to break and give information on the Gardner artifacts. He was given a polygraph test in regards to the whereabouts of the artwork, and he failed. He demanded a retest, and during the retest, he stated that Guarenti's widow had shown him the missing Rembrandt self-portrait, and during the story, the test registered that he was telling the truth. A few days after the test, the FBI raided Gentile's house and found a secret ditch under a floor in the backyard shed, but it was empty. His son said the ditch had flooded a few years prior, and his father had been very upset about what had been stored there. They also found a copy of the Boston Herald from March of 1990 that had a story regarding the theft with a piece of paper on how much each piece was worth on the black market. Gentile never changed his story and served his 30-month sentence, never attempting to leverage information for a shorter sentence. Later on, he did an interview where he said the FBI framed him and explained the paper with the prices was from a criminal who believed Guarenti had the artwork and wanted Gentile to be the middleman in the deal. When he was pressed about what had been in the ditch, he claims to not recall, but that he thought it may have been auto parts. Wouldn't that suck if it was really the artwork just laying in a ditch that flooded?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that it would be. I mean, I feel like even a dummy knows you can't do that to
buy. See, but artwork. I mean, they didn't care enough. They cut it with box cutters.
I mean, but I could see how that could be misinterpreted. But, like, you can't put anything in a ditch and hope it is fine once it comes out. You know what I mean? Like, I can't imagine.
Another Merlino associate possibly involved in the crime was David Turner. He started being investigated in 92 after someone tipped the authorities off to his possible involvement. Merlino was arrested the same year for cocaine trafficking and told the FBI that he could arrange the return of the paintings for a reduced sentence. He then asked for Turner to find the paintings, and Turner was unable to. He did say he believed they were in a church in South Boston. Merlino was released from prison in the mid-1990s, and it was determined that he didn't have direct access to the artwork, but maybe could broker a deal for the return. Although Turner continued to claim he was innocent, the FBI maintained a belief that he could have been one of the thieves. It is known that he was in Florida the days prior to the robbery, and there was record of credit card usage throughout the night of the robberies. But investigators believe that this could have been made to seem like he was there in order to create an alibi. They also believe that the second robber could have been friend George Reisfelder. He died in 1991. They were never able to locate any clues on his property or that of any friend or relative. His siblings did claim that he did have a painting that was similar to the Chez Tony in his bedroom, and his physique matched the description of the slimmer thief. Turner, Merlino, Rossetti, and the others were arrested in 99 on the day they planned to rob a Loomis Fargo vault. When Turner was questioned, they told him they believed he had access to the Gardner art, and if he returned the painting, they would allow him to go free. He declined and stated again he had no knowledge of the heist or the whereabouts of the items in question. He was found guilty of the planned heist on the Wells Fargo Loomis truck and sent to prison. On the 33rd anniversary of the theft, empty frames remain on the walls of the Gardner. Can you believe that? They still have the empty frames. None of the works have been recovered, despite a $10 million reward, nor has anyone been charged. Another development seemed to crop up last year. A tipster told museum investigators that Boston criminal Jimmy Marks, who was gunned down in a believed mob hit 11 months after the heist, had bragged about owning or hiding some of the paintings. We got some contacts from that story, but nothing that has been brought has really caused any conclusion. This is Anthony Amar, the museum's chief of security, tells The Independent. For his part, he believes the paintings are stashed probably not too far from the museum. 10 years ago, the FBI publicly said the same in a joint release with the Gardner and the U.S. Attorney's Office. The FBI believes with a high degree of confidence that in the years after the theft, the art was transported to Connecticut in the Philadelphia region, and some of the art was taken to Philadelphia where it was offered for sale by those responsible for the theft. Richard DeLauros, special agent in charge of the FBI's Boston office, said on March 18th in 2013, "The FBI believes with a high degree of confidence that in the years after the theft, the art was transported to Connecticut in the Philadelphia region, and some of the art was taken to Philadelphia where it was offered for sale by those responsible for the theft." That comes from a special agent in charge of the FBI's Boston office. Since that statement, more than a decade has passed, and there's still no sign of any of the pieces. The artwork and crime scene photos can be viewed at isgm.org/theft. It is important to the museum that these art pieces are not forgotten, and they're hopeful that they will someday be able to share them in person again. The Gardner Museum continues to work with the FBI on this case on a daily basis. They hope that the lost artwork can be recovered, and they believe that the $10 million reward for information leading to directly recovering all 13 pieces of art in good condition may get someone talking. The artwork and crime scene photos can actually be viewed at that website also. It's been 34 years. $10 million hasn't brought it. And the artwork is worth way more than $10 million at this point.
Yeah.
I can't remember what they said. I want to say it was like $500 million. But if that $10 million hasn't brought someone forward in the last 34 years, why would it suddenly? They're waiting for people to die, maybe?
Maybe, but even...
If you were 30 in 1994, how old would you be now?
I don't know.
What were you going to say? If you were... Yeah, you'd only be 60 right now. If you were 30 in 1994, you'd only be 60 right now. Right? That makes sense. So, I mean, someone could be walking around that had something to do with that right now, right? There's also a paranormal story at the museum. This is just, you're going to love. There's a painting on Isabella on display, and it said she paid $3,000 in 1880 for one of her favorite artists. His name was John Singer Sargent. She rejected and requested changes 8 times. Once it was complete, her husband asked her not to display the painting. He clearly didn't like it. Like, he told her not to display it. But now it is put up in the Gothic room, and employees of the museum don't love it. They kind of agree with her husband. In fact, they believe the painting is haunted by the namesake herself, and guards claim that during their checks in the middle of the night, if they shine their flashlights in its direction, the woman moves.
Ugh.
Right? Would you just stay away from that? But, I mean, you would think maybe, I mean, if she wasn't alive when her museum got robbed, but could you imagine she's a ghost floating around and saw them do that to her beloved artwork? Like, she's pissed, right?
Yeah.
The museum encourages people with new tips and concrete information to contact them at theft@gardnermuseum.org. No theories, please. They specifically request that. It is important to the museum and the world that the art pieces are not forgotten, and they are hopeful that they will someday be able to share them in person again. So. Thank you for listening to this episode of Haunting History Podcast. We love hearing from you, so be sure to like, follow, and comment on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Haunting History Podcast. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to all your favorites.
Visit our website at hauntinghistorypodcast.com for more information on each episode, links to our Patreon page, and all of our social media platforms.
Until next time, I'm Kat.
I'm Haley.
Remember, the living are far scarier than any ghost.